Roy Wang.
Hello, everybody. I'm Wayne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wayne.
And my sobriety date is September the 13th, 1991. That's through the grace of God, the generosity of a lot of people like you all in and out of AA, and me finally participating in my own rescue for a change. And I do have a home group. Matter of fact, newly minted, I recently joined the Buck Row New Hope group. And we meet on Friday nights in the Buck Row area. At 6 o'clock, we meet on Wednesdays at 7, and we have a beach meeting at 8:30 on Sunday mornings, you know, as long as the weather isn't inclement or whatever. And I do have a sponsor. He knows that he's my sponsor, and I do sponsor other men, and they actually know that I sponsor them, you know. So it's not a name-only kind of thing. Thanks, Steve, for asking me to do this. And I'm going to be honest with you all, I'm usually in the bed right about now, you know, I'm serious. I guess that's how I know, you know, that you're getting old, where the time you go to bed is actually earlier than the time you used to go out, right?
Right.
So, yeah. Well, I guess I'll just kind of start with, you know, a little bit of background about my family. I'm the oldest of three, and my mother, by the time she was 20, she had had all three of us already, right? And, you know, there's this joke that goes around that my mom and my dad and I were actually at their senior prom together. You know, my mom was she was 17 when she had me. And, you know, back in the 50s, that was a, you know, bit of a stigma, you know, on that high school pregnancy thing. And just so y'all can put your calculators away, I was born during the Eisenhower administration, okay? All right? You know, my dad was one of the probably best athletes to come out of our area. In fact, he was so good, he actually was given a contract to play quarterback for the Bears. And that was a big deal back in, you know, during that time for a black person to you know, be offered to play quarterback. But my dad loved the streets and wine, women, and song more than anything else. And if you ever saw the movie American Gangster, that would basically be my dad's story, okay? And I can recall, you know, at an early age, having to go up the street to get some of his friends to bring him back around, you know, so to speak. And I'm not gonna blame, you know, my dad or his lifestyle for what I did, because every drink or non-conference approved substance that I took, you know, I did it voluntarily. You know, nobody made me do it. And you know, I think one of the straw that broke the camel's back with my mom and dad being together, we were living in Los Angeles at the time, and there was a movement going on in the Oakland Bay Area of California back then, and my dad took me to one of their rallies, and I actually went to a Panther rally, and of course, I couldn't keep my mouth shut, so when I got home, you know, the first thing I told my mom was where we went, and I had never seen her that mad before in my life. And that was pretty much the end, you know, of their marriage right there. And, you know, early on, I actually got in trouble before I even picked up, you know, a drink or anything like that. I remember the third grade, this kid was picking on me. And back then we had the skates that you had to have a skate key to take off to kind of go over your shoe. So he's steadily messing with me, and I'm sitting there methodically taking that skate off. And I just took it apart and I smacked him right across the face with it. And I think they said it took like 44 stitches to sew his face up, right? And this is in the third grade. Fourth grade, I'm in class, and there's this, you know, big kid in there. He's picking on everybody. And of course, I opened my mouth. I said, why don't you try that on somebody who ain't afraid of you? Next thing I know, he and I are tussling and going at it. And I got him right by a window, and whoop, out he went. We were like four stories up, too. Okay, yeah. And, you know, luckily he had two things going for him. One, he was a kid, and two, he landed in bushes. And I didn't go to the principal's office that day. They took me straight downtown. And at this time, my mother and father were not together. And when they showed up there together, I knew that it was pretty bad. And then when I saw them agreeing on what to do to me, I knew it was real bad because they didn't agree on anything, right? They thought it would be a good idea for me to enroll me in martial arts. That way I would find a productive way to channel my anger. And basically all that did for me was made me skilled and crazy, you know, pretty much. Yeah, that's all it did for me. And I remember the first time I actually purposely wanted to, pick up a substance. This was one of the times where my mom and dad were the back and forth, splitting up, getting back together. I went in the refrigerator and got two bottles of my dad's Ripple. And if y'all old enough, you know, remember what that was. And then I went in the junk drawer and pulled out a couple of his cigarettes that you roll yourself, okay? And I knew right when I did that, I was 10, but I knew I wanted to feel like that all the time. I mean, from the very first time, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And I spent from 1968 when I first did that until I crawled in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1991 chasing how I felt right then. And I never caught up with it. Never caught up with it again. And almost died a few times trying. And you know, one of the saving graces for me was I was always made good grades, right? And I was always active in sports. And, you know, active in the band and all of that stuff. And I can remember this one time, the teacher, you know, sent me home with a note to my mother about, my hearing. And by this time, we were actually living in New York, the South Bronx. And my mother, dragging these three small children from one end of New York City to the other to take me to a hearing specialist. So the guy, we get to the hearing specialist and he runs all these tests, you know, and everything. And he goes back to my mother and he says, Mrs. Denson, your son's hearing is fine. He just chooses to ignore you. And I'll never forget the look of relief on her face, quickly followed by that same look she gave my dad when he took me to that Panther rally. And I can see my brother and sister scattering because they knew what was coming next, right? And see, back then, I grew up when you got whoopings. It didn't matter when or where you were, man. You just got it, right? And that was a pattern for me. It was. And, you know, I continued kind of getting in trouble, but I did very well in school. Matter of fact, by the time I got in high school, you know, I was playing sports. I was, you know, in the band. And I was an honor student. And, of course, I was hanging out, you know, with my kind of people that drank like I did, you know, and did the non-conference approved substances like I did too. And, you know, by the time I was in high school, I had already been arrested probably 7 times, you know, easily, right? And when I would get in trouble, they wouldn't send me to the principal. They would either send me to the coach or send me to the band director. And I was more afraid of the band director than I was the coach or the principal, right? Yeah. But I did, you know, finish high school. And like I said, I had like a 3.5 GPA, you know. So it wasn't that I didn't do my work. But see, the thing with me was I would finish before everybody else, right? And then I'd get bored. And then I'd get creative. And then I'd get in trouble, right, for my creativity. And I wound up going to college on a band scholarship, and it paid for all 4 years, right? And it was, because it was a 5-year major, I had to take an overloaded schedule, you know, almost every semester. And I finished with a 3.75 GPA, and I can probably count the number of times on one hand that I wasn't either doing some kind of a substance or drinking or drunk or whatever in all those 4 years. And if I have a dollar for every time the band director there threatened to take my scholarship from me, I could probably have retired then, you know. And I continued to get in trouble though, but see, because I was so good at what I did, I had all these enablers. And he would come bail me out of jail, you know, or the assistant band director would come bail me out of jail. And matter of fact, at one time, the chancellor of the school came and bailed me out, right? And somehow or another, my mom, the general is what we call her, she kind of got wind of what I was doing, right? And she showed a surprise visit, I guess you could say, yeah. And she had no problem chewing me out, smacking me upside my head in front of my friends and everything. She had no problem doing that, right? And that worked for a little while. But I still, you know, kept getting in trouble and everything, and I did manage to graduate from college. And by this time, I was dating a young lady, and I, you know, went home with her for the summer. And, you know, her parents were throwing around the M word, right? And I, the marriage word, I'm like, well, okay, let me do this. I'm going to go home and talk to my folks about it, you know, and we'll see what happens. I ain't go back down there. I did. I did not. The only time I went back down was to get my transcripts for the Army. And, you know, I've since made amends and all of that stuff with her. And, you know, I kept getting in trouble. And I remember this, the last time I faced this particular judge, he looked at me and he looked at my, you know, my college transcripts and all that stuff. And he looked at my record and he was like, I can't believe this is the same person. He said, Mr. Denson, one way or another, I am not going to see you in my courtroom again. And I'm not even going to look at the charges because it probably has something to do with you fighting. So since you like to fight so much, I'm going to give you a choice today. You can either go fight for your country, or I can send you back to where you came from. And I wasn't one of them people that, you know, would enter the courtroom from the front. I was usually brought from in back. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Not wearing my own clothes. Yeah, wearing clothes that they supplied to me and whatnot. And that was not a hard decision for me to make, you know. So I wound up, the judge wound up putting me in the United States Army. And he did me a tremendous favor. He really, really did. And I actually thanked that man till his dying day, you know, for doing that for me. And of course, the Army knew all about what I did and the conditions that, you know, I was put in there and whatnot. So I was basically at their mercy, right? And my thing was I was gonna do a couple of years, you know, get some graduate school money, go to grad school, blah, 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 blah. But they had other ideas for me. And I was afraid of heights. I mean, deathly afraid of heights. So the first school they sent me to after basic training was jump school. And I was terrified the first real jump that I had. And we had, you know, partied and all that stuff the night before and, you know, had drank and everything. I was real thirsty that next morning. So I, you know, was trying to kill that thirst, you know, and everything. And we got to, you know, pretty close to the jump zone, I had to use the bathroom. I had to use the bathroom real bad. And it was time for me to jump. And like I said, this was my first jump. I was scared, I was. When I landed, I didn't have to use the bathroom anymore. And my nickname for the rest of that time was Mr. Peabody, right? And I remember meeting this one guy during jump school, you know, there was a he was one of the instructors, and he had this real neat patch and everything. I said, well, what's that? He said, you know, he was Special Forces. I says, well, what do they do? And he kind of, you know, gave me a little brief into what they did. I says, do they chase women? He said, yeah. I says, do they drink and party? He said, hard. I said, do they catch any of these women that they chase? He said, yeah. I was like, where do I sign, right? Where do I sign, right? And before I know it, they made me a warrant officer, and I had my own, you know, team, and I actually wound up going to scuba school too while I was there. And again, I kept getting in trouble. And you know, the big book talks about, you know, because, you know, to the employers that person has such an affection, you know, for that individual, and they keep them long beyond probably what they should have. And I can recall a number of times my commanding officer coming and bailing me out, right? And the last time he came and got me, actually had his bathrobe and bedroom slippers on. He wasn't real happy about it either. And he basically told me that if he doesn't make general, he's gonna come and find me, right? And I had kind of starting to burn out, you know, in Special Forces, and they saw that I had a music degree, so they sent me over to Little Creek to the School of Music over there, where they trained, at that time, they trained the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps band people. And this was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. This was in 1984. By this time, I was married and had a toddler, and they sentenced me, which is what it felt like, to one meeting a week, and it was over in Ocean View. It was called Junks and Drunks. And man, I remember going in, I'm sitting there in the back, I didn't want to be there. And I remember this guy came up to me after the meeting, and he looked me right in the eye, and he told me this. He said, "Wayne, if you keep doing what you're doing and living like you're living, everything you heard that happened to us is going to happen to you too." Right? And I pretty much told him where he could put that. And I spent from 1984 till I crawled back in here in 1991 proving that guy right. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, every time I went back out in them 7 years, not only did things get worse for me each time, things got worse faster for me each time. And I noticed that I was getting arrested faster. I noticed they were keeping me longer. I mean, this was every single time I went back out. And when I thought I didn't have anything else left to lose, I found something I didn't even think I had to forfeit. And by this time, wife was starting to get a little tired, you know, of my shenanigans. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back with that was I told her when I said, "Look, I'm going to the store to get some bread, milk, and I'll be back." Right. So 2 weeks later, I'm calling her collect from Colombia. I'm talking like cartel Colombia, right? To wire some money to get me out of jail, right? I was running with some not so nice people, and by this time my behavior was so erratic, nobody could predict what I was gonna do or how I was gonna act. And say what you wanna say about those people, but they're organized, right, about what they do, meticulous about what they do. And I'm gonna tell you right now, I was not down there to pick coffee beans. That was not my purpose for going down there. And even they got tired of me. And I remember the guy coming to get me, you know, and bringing me up front and everything. And I says, "Oh, y'all releasing me?" And he said, "Yeah, somebody, you know, got you out." And I remember when I was collecting my stuff, I saw this, it was a one-way plane ticket back to the United States and a note that said, "Don't come back," right? I mean, I wore my welcome out with them too, but that's what I did. I wore people out. I did. I mean, I would absolutely drain people. And when I came back home, I noticed that I did stop at the store and get bread and milk on my way home. I did. Yeah. And when I got home, I noticed that I was like, there was stuff, you know, strewn on the lawn. I said, "Man, it looks a lot like my stuff, right? It looks a lot like my stuff." And then I tried my key, and it didn't work, right? And she finally comes to the door, and, you know, I show her the milk and the bread, and I said, "I told you I was going to pick this," and man, she slammed the door in my face, right? You know, the nerve, you know, after all the sacrifices I made for her, right? You know, that was what I thought, right? And, you know, I did what every good, you know, supposedly gangster alcoholic does, you know. I came back to Virginia and moved in with Mom, right? yeah. And the general basically laid down the law to me, too. You know, she says, "You're not going to do this, that, and the other." And, you know, I was still making them half-hearted attempts, you know, at trying to stay sober. In fact, while I was in California, I went through a 30-day treatment out there, right? And that worked for maybe 3 months. And it wasn't long before I was back to the races again. So now I'm back here in Virginia. And another half-hearted attempt, right? Actually managed to string together pretty close to 3 months. And I was going to fly out to California to get, by this time I had two daughters now. And I was going to bring them back here, you know, and everything, you know, so they could spend time with my mother, with their grandmother. And I get on the flight, and they had what they call that champagne flight.
Oh, no.
And I actually survived that. I did, you know, so I felt real good about that. So I'm thinking, well, maybe, you know what? Maybe I've been making too big of a deal out of this, right? So I was supposed to meet a gentleman who was my sponsor while I was living out there, you know, at the airport. And between that connecting flight and that landing, I'm thinking, I should probably go back to the old hood, you know, just so they could see how good I'm doing, see how good I look, right? And so now I'm figuring out a way to duck this guy, okay? And, you know, I land and I manage to duck him. You know, of course, I go check in with plaintiff number one first to let her know that I'm in town and I'm going to, you know, bring the girls back the next morning and everything. And, you know, bring them back, bring him to Virginia the next morning. And, of course, I go back to the old hood. And y'all know exactly what happened. You know what happened, right? That was pretty much the beginning of the end. And, I mean, it had gotten to a point where if I wasn't putting something in me, you know, if I'd stop for a couple hours, I'd start getting sick. And I think I knew right then when I would hear people talking about being physically addicted, I think that's what that meant. You know, I mean, I would really start getting sick and I start seeing things and I'm scratching, but I'm not itching any, you know, and it was pretty bad. But and by this time, I actually met the gentleman who wound up sponsoring me for over 21 years until he passed away. And, you know, I'm still in and out and back and forth. And finally, the convention, the state convention of Alcoholics Anonymous was being held in Hampton that year. It was in 1991, September the 13th. And Father Martin was one of the speakers for that. And the gentleman that spoke that Friday night, who's a dear friend of mine now, Hollis Dodge, and my home group, you know, they had a little table and a booth there and everything. And my sponsor thought it would be a good idea for me to go to this thing, right? And I'm shaking and sweating and I mean, and when I get there, I see like close to 2,000 clean, sober, and happy people. And I mean, I was miserable. And the only way I can describe how I felt that day was it felt like somebody ate my soul. And if any of you know what that feels like, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I had finally got to a point, you know, to where a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous get to. You know, it's like, I don't care what I have to do in order for this to work. I don't care anymore. And I think I said the most profound prayer I ever said in my life, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore, right? And I'll share this with you. I might not have had all I wanted while I was out there doing my thing, but man, September the 13th, 1991, I had all I could stand. Mm-hmm. I'm serious. And I knew what that other kind of pain that you all talk about was, you know, that somebody ate my soul pain, you know, because I always had a pretty high threshold for physical pain. Heck, I've been shot, stabbed, caught on fire. Yeah, literally. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. But man, that feeling like somebody ate my soul kind of pain, I don't think I'd ever really, really felt that until that day. And I remember, you know, it was a running joke in my old home group. They said that whole weekend, somebody was following me around with a mop and a bucket cleaning up behind me, right? And that day when I showed up there, Hollis Dodge actually, you know, he sat me down and he said, you know what? You don't ever have to feel like you're feeling now again if you don't want to. Just do a few simple things one day at a time, right? And you all gave me the secret. You told me that I don't have to drink if I don't, you know, if I don't want to. And then you gave me the second part of the secret. Even if I want to, I still don't have to. And see, that was the part that always eluded me, that even if I want to, I don't have to. And I remember my sponsor telling me that, you know, the first time that I want to get loaded and I actually don't, that was going to be my breakthrough. Right. He was absolutely right. Through God's grace, I made it through that weekend without going into DTs or whatever. And that Monday morning, my mother and a family friend took me up to Richmond, to the VA hospital up there. And they, you know, checked me in and everything. And I don't remember very much about them first couple of days. I don't. But what they told me was they had strapped me down, you know, put me in restraints, right? I don't remember any of this. They said I actually broke through two sets of restraints. I don't remember any of that. I don't remember any of it. And there was these two guys that would bring a meeting in, you know, to us. And they would, you know, come and take, you know, take me to meetings outside when I was cleared, you know, to do that. And they made it clear they didn't like me, and I made it clear I ain't like them either. But they were doing that so they could stay sober. And I remember wanting to get loaded real bad, and I just started praying. And when I opened my eyes, I found myself next to a phone. And I guess that was God's way of telling me, dude, you need to call somebody. And I called these two guys, and they came and got me. And they took me to a meeting. And then they took me on a 12-step call. And the guy that we were going to see was really, I mean, he was in real bad shape. He was in worse shape than I was. And I mean, he was physically ill. And by this time, I actually had a pair of new sneakers on. That was the first pair of new sneakers I had on my feet in a long time. This guy got sick on my new sneakers, right? But you know what? I didn't get loaded that day. And I knew right then and there that this thing worked, not because you told me, but because I actually tried it. Right. And it worked. So I knew the next time something like that would happen, I had a good point of reference now. And right around 30 days, we were at a meeting, and I was ranting and raving and blah, and this guy had the audacity to tell me to take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. And even at that stage, I knew that was AA code for shut up. I didn't appreciate him telling me that. And we were at it was a Friday night meeting in Richmond at the, we're sitting around this big conference room table with those big rolling chairs. Mm-hmm. I picked my chair up and I threw it at him. And just as that chair was leaving my hands, all I could think of was, oh God, you're going back to jail. You're going back to jail, right? And I was aiming for his head. I was. If he hadn't moved, that's exactly where it would have hit him. And they told me, keep coming back. We know you're scared. Let us love you till you can love yourself. I was not expecting that. I was expecting somebody to call the police. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm in Richmond when this happened, and my sponsor is in Newport News, right? Somehow, he gets wind of this. So they gave me such a poor prognosis in Richmond, they sent me to Hampton to the VA there, and I spent another 10 months in there, and I needed every single minute of every single day of that, too. And when I get back to Hampton, my sponsor tells me, so you like throwing chairs at people, huh? I'm like, God, how did he find out? And he says, you know, this is a safe place. And you behaving like that, it's not making it a safe place for everyone else. And he basically told me in no uncertain terms, was I to behave that way ever again in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't say it the way that I'm saying it, right? He was like this close to me, and he was yelling, and he was calling me some very hurtful names, right? And yeah, that's how he told me that. But that's what I needed to hear. And he would bring a speaker in every, at that time was every fourth Tuesday. And he said, well, you're going to help me with this. I'm like, man, I want to go to meetings outside. Huh? He says, I didn't ask you. You're going to help me with this. So it started with me helping him, and it ended up with me actually taking that over. And I did that for like, for decades. You know, even when I moved out of town and came back, I picked it up again up until when they had the pandemic, when they restricted, you know, people from doing that. And there was a real sense of urgency for me to go through the steps. And I remember him asking me this one question. He says, Wayne, how did you feel when it was, what you were doing was all gone? And you knew there was absolutely no way you could get any more right then. How did you feel? And that told me everything I needed to know about myself then and there, because anytime it ran out, it was prematurely for me, right? And it felt like, you know, it felt like the world had ended, basically, because I couldn't get any more. And he and I sat down, and what he did for me was we went through the steps, we went through the traditions, and we went through the concepts, because I was taught it's a three-legacy deal. And if I do anything less than that with people that come into my life to work with, I'm not only doing them a disservice, I'm doing myself a disservice, and I'm doing Alcoholics Anonymous a disservice. And just, you know, right quick, when we were going through the steps, one of them that I kind of got hung up on was when we got to the second step, and he had me to read the chapter of the agnostics. I'm like, why you got me doing it? I already believe in God. He says, well, you need to read it again. And this went on for like until the fourth time when I read it, and the light finally came on. It had a whole lot more to do with me being open-minded, because I was going to hear things in here and be told to do things in here that made absolutely no sense at face value, like you got to give it away to keep it. That didn't make any sense to me, right? It didn't. And when we got to the third step, we did the third step prayer, just like it is in the book. You know, we got on and he said that prayer. And I remember being nervous about doing that, because I was like, man, I'm kind of, you know, afraid of what I might turn into. And he says, well, son, anything is better than what you are right now. So don't worry about it. And, you know, the way that, you know, he told me that we really meant business. And when I did that, was we went on with the rest of the steps. And, of course, you know, the fourth step, we did it just like it is in the book. You know, fear, resentment, sexual misconduct, and then that fourth column, the part that I played in it. And, you know, the fifth step, you know, we did it just like it is in the book. And, you know, I had to have somebody tell me that if there's a name for it, somebody else has already done it. And I hear a lot of times where people will have that one thing that they're not going to tell anybody, that they're going to take it to their grave. And we've had people, unfortunately, literally do that. I don't have that one thing. Somebody knows about it. And what I've learned about that is when somebody else knows about it, it starts to lose power over me, because now it's got two of us it has to deal with and not just me by myself. And when we went through 6 and 7, the big takeaway I got from that was, you know, it's not my job to remove any defective character that I have. It clearly tells me that it's God's job to do that. My job, however, is to actually behave like he's done it, which ain't always easy. We got to step 8. We made that list just like it talks about. And we divided that list up into who should be seen immediately, who could possibly wait, and divine appointment. And for some reason, I thought divine appointment meant I was going to get out of it, right? I have had more divine appointments in Alcoholics Anonymous than anything else. And like a lot of alcoholics, I owed money when I came here. Back child support, fines, and all of this stuff. I was pretty close to mid six figures in debt when I came to AA in 1991. And it took me 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to pay every nickel of that off. And I didn't always have good jobs either, because people wasn't lining up to hire a felon. They just weren't. And there was this one amends that I was really having trouble with. It was kind of tricky because the guy had died, and I didn't have anything to do with that. I just want to clear that up right now because I know that there's no statute of limitations on murder, okay? And I remember telling my sponsor about it, and he says, well, does this guy have a family? I said, well, yeah, he does. He said, do they celebrate Thanksgiving? I said, as far as I know, they do. He says, well, here's what you're going to do. You are going to buy them a Thanksgiving dinner with all the trimmings and everything. And you're going to do this until this doesn't bother you anymore. And now, keep in mind, I'm trying to pay down this mid six figures of debt, right? And, you know, I said, what, you know, he says, well, you know what? If it doesn't cost you something, it's not going to mean anything to you. Okay? And, you know, I did what he said. I did exactly what he said. And in them 16 years, though, I had to do without a lot of stuff that I really liked. You know, I did. And, but I did what, you know, what was suggested. You know, write a letter to all these different places and put a little bit of money in with the letter and let them know what it is you're trying to do. Because he kind of made it clear to me, he said, these people are more interested in you paying them than they are about locking your sorry butt up again. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. They are. And, you know, when we got to step 10, that actually gives me the opportunity to practice 4 through 9. And it actually says that continue to take personal inventory. That means it's an ongoing thing. And when we were wrong, not if, when. So that means I'm going to be wrong. To promptly admit it and not, you know, kind of hold on to it. Because if I let it roll around up here enough, I'm going to come up with a reason either not to do it or see where I was more right than wrong. And, you know, which is a load of crap. And, you know, I found out that that's not so much for the other person, but that's so I can be free. And, you know, the 11th step, that prayer and meditation, it gives me perspective. It really, really does. And something that I do every day is from the bottom of page 85 to the end of the chapter in the big book, it's all about step 11. And it gives me specific instructions on what I'm supposed to do before I go to bed, what I'm supposed to do when I wake up, what I'm supposed to do when I get agitated or whatever. I mean, it gives me specific directions, and that's what I love about this program. No guesswork. It's already been figured out, so I ain't got to try to figure anything out. And, of course, step 12, you know, having had a spiritual awakening, which tells me by the time I get through those steps, something's different, you know. And if I want a spiritual awakening, then I'm going to have to go through the steps to get it, right? And, you know, practicing these principles in all of our affairs, which is easy to do with you all, a bit more of a challenge to do with the people closest to me. And, you know, carry this message to other alcoholics. And, you know, the message you all gave me was, we found a way up and a way out, and it's here for you if you want it, mm-hmm. Right? And, you know, if the only place that I'm actually practicing this stuff is in AA, then I missed the whole point of being in AA. You know, because I'm supposed to become a useful and productive member of society, right? And if the only place I'm doing that is in here, you know, then I'm missing the whole point, right? And if I treat you all better than I treat my wife, you know, then I'm missing the point of being in here. And, you know, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've actually had the opportunity to remarry. And she's one of us. And, you know, some of y'all know, you know, they know her. And we didn't meet in the conventional boy meets girl on AA campus way, because I tried that too, right? And that blew up. We were both involved in service work. You know, at that particular time, I was the DCM, District 8, and she was a GSR in Richmond for her home group. And we would see each other at conferences, you know, conventions and all of that stuff. And our circles widened until they intersected. And the gentleman who I was talking about, Hollis Dodge, had told me I didn't have to feel like this again if I didn't want to. He actually officiated our wedding. And, you know, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had the opportunity to, you know, be in service work, you know, from making coffee for my home group, which I never had coffee in my life, but I was told that y'all like it strong. So instead of 2 scoops, I put in 2.5. Hope somebody would complain. Nobody ever did, right? Yeah. And I GSR for my home group, and wound up eventually being a DCM. And then I actually got involved at the Virginia area, and of all things, I was the chairman of the conventions committee, you know, for the Virginia area, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I actually got sober at a convention, right, 1991. And I mean, how cool is that, huh? And when I rotated out of that, I found a nice place to land, being a part of the Oceanfront Conference Committee Planning Board. Mm-hmm. Because I was taught, you know, to always be doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous for Alcoholics Anonymous. And they threw out these numbers. They said one out of 33 people, you know, that are introduced to AA stay sober. But out of that one in 33, 9 out of 10 that get involved in some form of service work end up staying. So I'm not a mathematician, but 9 out of 10 odds are a whole lot better than 1 out of 33, right? Mm-hmm. I had to be a math major to figure that out. And, you know, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had the opportunity to go back to school to actually finish up a PhD and gotten involved in a church, the same church I've been a part of for over 30 years now. And I'm actually in the music ministry there, you know. And I remember when I came back to AA, I had already forfeited and sold all my musical instruments for, you know, non-conference approved substances. And I remember, praying one day, I was like, you know, God, if you ever give me a chance to play music again, I'm going to do it for you. And he made good on his promise. You know, he did. And I try to do my best to uphold my end of that bargain, too. And, you know, my daughter's grown. In fact, my granddaughters, one's going to be 19 at the end of this month. Jeez. And my youngest granddaughter's going to be 15 this summer. Grandchildren, right? I know. And they think their grandfather is the absolute coolest. So I must be doing something right anytime teenage girls think I'm cool, because normally teenage girls don't like anybody, okay? They just don't. And, you know, I've had some ups and downs since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some years back, my oldest daughter passed away, and she would be 40 this year. And I was supposed to lead a meeting when I got the news, and I called my sponsor and I told him, you know, what had happened and what my, you know, I was supposed to do that evening. And he took me to a page in the big book where it basically says that God will allow us to match calamity with serenity, right? And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has always kept its commitment to me no matter what. So I have to keep my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what. And I remember when it was time to fly out to California for the service, I called ahead of time so y'all knew I was coming. And you guys met me at the airport. I didn't duck you this time. And you all wouldn't leave me alone, even when I wanted you to, you wouldn't. And they actually had the audacity to ask me to do what I'm doing now at a meeting there. And I didn't feel like it, but, you know, y'all taught me it's not about what I feel, it's about what I do. And how I feel will eventually catch up with what I do. You all taught me that. And, you know, like I said, today my life is a whole lot different, you know, than it was when I came in here. And, you know, what I was told about the traditions, that the first one works best when the other 11 are practiced, right? And, you know, y'all gave me a simple little thing here, you know, the steps keep me from committing suicide. The traditions keep me from committing homicide, and the concepts keep me from committing genocide, right? That's what y'all told me. I mean, I got that from you. I'm not that clever to come up with something like that myself. I'm not. And, you know, if you really want to know how I'm doing, ask my wife.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Ask her, because she's with me all the time. Mm-hmm. And when y'all see her, most of the time, she's smiling, right? I'm a firm believer, you know, in happy spouse, happy house, happy wife, happy life, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in that. You know, I may be the king of the castle, but if the queen ain't happy, It's going to be some hassle in a castle, right? Yeah. And I'm going to read something to you real quick before I close. And it's about emotional sobriety. And it says that if we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependency and its consequent unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to 12-step ourselves and others into emotional sobriety. And it goes on to say, it's useful to realize that emotional sobriety is not merely the management of one's emotions, which is quite frankly a fool's game. When emotions surge, we lack power over them in the same way that we lack power over alcohol, drugs, and other substances and process addictions. Instead, we are pointed to root causes, the underlying dependencies from which emotional upsets emerge. When those are unresolved, emotional sobriety falls upon us. We are struck emotionally sober. Mm-hmm. Man,
thank you.
That is quite a state, you know, to be in and to strive for. Yeah. I want to thank Steve again for allowing me to do this, and thank you all for having this place so I can come to it.
Thank you.